This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Resolve Mysteries Podcast.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Season 3, Episode 21, and this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And here we go. For every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization, and for this month, we are donating to Angels with Misplaced Wings. And we also are having a magnet giveaway. We have 50 magnets to give away. So if you leave us a review, just give it a little screen grab and send it to us via email and along with your address, and we will send you a magnet.
Come on, do it.
Do it.
Eliza's on a review campaign. Don't mess with it. She's going to come for you.
The presidential campaign's over. George's over. I need another campaign to get on. So there's not other bigger problems in the world. I'm going to stick with now moving to our little podcast. Bury those one stars. Hashtag bury the one stars.
Ooh, I like that.
That's my new hashtag campaign.
Love it.
And we also have a few patrons to shout out.
Catherine M., Maya S., and Nicole G., thank you so much, you true sweeties.
Thank you. So if you would like to support us on Patreon, you would get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, and goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast. And just another little reminder that for our finale of Season 3, we're going to be doing a little chat with you guys on Patreon. That's going to be happening Sunday, May 2nd, and we will be posting the episode a day early so that we can all listen to it together and do a little chat while we listen.
It's super fun. Super fun.
It should be a very good time.
And another reason to join the Patreon, and the chat will be happening through Slack, but we'll post instructions for all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's awesome.
All right, everybody, what are we covering in part one of this episode?
I have the first segment, and it's a wanted segment, and it is Richard Bocklage, Dick Bitch, extraordinaire.
And I also have a wanted, but it's not really a wanted, about Lieutenant Paul Wipke.
And then in part two,
I have a Lost Loves, and it's the story of Gary Bickman.
And then I have a Missing Persons, but as we said before, it's more of a wanted, and it's about Astarte Davis.
And part two will be coming out in a week.
Yay!
All right, let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, so the first segment begins by Stack telling us that in March of 1980, Dr. Tanya Koprick fell in love with Richard Bocklage. She was a practicing resident at the Truman Medical Center in Kansas City, Missouri, and he was a pharmacy student at the University of Missouri. Stack says that it seemed like an unlikely match. Richard was 10 years younger than Tanya, and he had grown up in St. Louis, the, quote, quintessential all-American boy. In 1975, Tanya had emigrated from Yugoslavia to study medicine, leaving behind all of her friends and family. Tanya was a badass. She worked her ass off to get to the U.S., and then she got into school, and she got into med school, and then she got a residency at a super reputable hospital in 5 years. It was pretty amazing.
Wow, good for her.
Yeah, amazing.
She did all of it on her own, too. So Stack says that at 34, she seemed to have achieved the American dream, except for one thing. Tanya longed for someone to share her life with. And then, like a fairy tale as old as time, she met a charming, manipulative human love bomb, and he ruined everything. Enter Richard Bocklage. Stack says that Richard was young and dynamic and showered Tanya with attention. Soon after they met, he moved into Tanya's apartment. And 6 months later, Richard proposed and Tanya accepted. But her friends didn't like Richard and didn't want her to marry him. Ivan Gregoric, Tanya's friend, says that he did not really like Bocklage because he was using her, quote, financially and morally. Gregorik says that Richard was using Tanya for a lot of things, like her credit card and her car. Stack says that Richard spent more and more time with Tanya and less time in class. Midway through his sophomore year, he fell behind in his studies. Tanya didn't know that Richard was about to fail out of school. Jane Lee, Richard's academic advisor, says that Richard wasn't motivated. He wanted to be a pharmacist, but you have to want it badly enough to devote many, many hours to academic study, and she's not sure he was willing to do that. On July 19, 1980, university officials notified Richard that he was academically ineligible. Basically, they kicked him out of school. Richard demanded that Tanya use her connections in the admissions department to have him readmitted to school. Tanya refused. She thought it was Richard's responsibility to solve the problem. Gregorik says that he was thinking that Richard was, quote, down to drugs or alcohol because his behavior was changing. Richard began to experience violent mood swings. For 3 weeks, Tanya tolerated his outbursts. Finally, on September 2nd, she broke off the engagement. Koprick's friends feared that Baklich would kill her, and she had the locks in her apartment changed. So he went from, like, being kind of an asshole to turning into a knockdown, drag-out maniac in these 3 weeks. And I think that Tanya really believed that she had found someone who was as passionate about their career as she was and someone who really loved working in medicine and helping people. But she ended up with this guy who didn't work, spent all of her money freely. And I also read that Richard wanted Koprick to pay his way through medical school. And she was like, no, like, no, yeah. Imagine, honey, do you have an extra, what, $150,000?
Yeah, seriously.
How much does it go to medical school? All right, so here's where it gets pretty bizarre. So 2 weeks later, 2 weeks after the breakup, Richard Baklich returned to class. So he's thrown out of school, and then one day, dude rolls in a white lab coat and just starts doing the work that everyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, imagine how creepy and weird that must be for your fellow students who definitely know what's up in the medical program, and then your professor.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, whoa.
Yeah, everyone's like, okay. I could just imagine the room, like the vibe.
Well, and today, you'd be scared of them coming in for like a mass shooting or something.
Back then, they didn't really have that much of that yet.
Right.
So the professor who was teaching the class knew that Richard had a temper and was unstable. So she asked the assistant dean to speak with him. And then there's this reenactment that, oh my God, this is such a dark story, but I found the reenactment so funny because the actors were really, really into it. They were really here for it. So Richard's trying to lie to the dean in this reenactment, and he's saying, oh, admissions told him that he could come back, but it would take a few weeks, which obviously that would never happen.
No.
And then the dean tells him, well, he has to take it up with admissions. And Richard just throws his hands up in the air and starts saying, forget it, forget it. And then he walks down the hall, rips off his white lab coat, and goes, ugh! Throws the white lab coat, and it accidentally lands on the water fountain, so it's kind of hanging there. And then the dean goes, well, okay. And then he, like, walks back into the room. I found it so funny that I rewound it a couple times. Him going, like, oh, in the hallway and throwing the lab coat, it just killed me. I don't know why.
So dramatic.
I haven't slept a lot recently, so. So Jane Lee says that Richard always gave her the impression that anything that happened was not his fault. He could just not cope with the fact that he was failing out and it was his responsibility. He couldn't believe that this was happening to him. This all-American boy just couldn't believe that actions have consequences. And when you fail your classes and get kicked out of school, you can't just gaslight an entire university into allowing you back in.
Can you believe it?
Darn well, it. Wonders never cease. It is darn so it. Hard out there for the all-American boy, I have to say. Increasingly desperate, Richard wrote to the school officials begging them to reconsider his case. I mean, aside from the failing grades and the total inability to take personal responsibility, I can't imagine anybody would be super excited to have this clearly unhinged person back on campus. They were probably like, it's not even about the grades, dude.
Mm-hmm.
You've got something going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You creepy.
Yeah.
You creepy.
The timeline is really important in this story, and UM doesn't do a really great job there very much. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks ago, so I think it's important. So I think the letter was probably written about September 12th. And then these things all happened very rapidly in the next few days. This also came from my research. This isn't in the segment. The letter gets written on September 12th. On September 16th, Bocklid showed up to Tanya's house angrily and demanded that Koprick return the engagement ring and other gifts that he had bought her, which is so pathetic. I mean, the engagement mm-hmm. ring, no, but other gifts, mm-hmm. really? Mm-hmm. Okay, you can take back your teddy bear, you fucking loser. Mm-hmm. On September 17th, Koprick wrote a letter to her parents talking about Bocklid and the breakup. The letter states, quote, "He is like a fury, totally going crazy and behaving imprudently." And she wrote about Richard's feelings of inferiority and envy. Mm. On September 18th at 3 p.m., the admissions committee convened to determine Richard's fate, and the decision was unanimous. Richard's appeal was denied, and a secretary was ordered to call him with the news. And the secretary's probably like, I don't get paid enough for this shit. You call him. So this is how intense and scary Richard was. The committee basically runs from the meeting, because they wanted to avoid a confrontation with Richard. So I think they were supposed to meet, say, between 3 p.m. and 3:30. Mm-hmm. And they made the decision and they left the meeting early and completely dispersed. They are leaving because they know if they see this person, he's going to lose his shit. And that's super scary that he's able to intimidate this group of people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They've seen enough of his poor behavior. So at 3:45, two professors spotted Richard driving toward the dean's office and then immediately headed in the opposite direction. Presumably, Richard had gotten the phone call from that poor secretary that he wasn't allowed back in school and sped over there, hoping to confront the board. Bocklid roamed the hallways searching for the dean of admissions. Under his arm, he carried a large manila folder. And I was thinking like a mailer, but it's one of those accordion folders.
Yeah.
Oh.
You could absolutely put a handgun in there. Mm. So some witnesses feared that it concealed a weapon. Mm. And in the reenactment, anybody in the hallway, he's like, do you know where the dean is? And everyone's like, no. And then he goes into the office and he says to the secretary, is the dean here? And she says, no. And he says, well, I'll just wait. And she's like, well, I don't know if he's going to be back today. And he's like, well, I'll just wait for him. And she was like, suit yourself. So then he's agitated. He hangs out for a minute and then he goes back into the hallway and leaves. 3 hours later, at around 8 p.m. on September 18th, Tanya Koprick returned to her apartment after work. As she was getting out of her car, Bocklid shot her 3 times in the head with a .45 automatic. He just shoots her, boom, right in her face. Mm-hmm. Close range, that's the word, phrase I was looking for. Warren Miller of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department says that there was a witness at the scene and that she saw a man walk up to the side of Dr. Koprick's car and shoot her 3 times in the face. She recognized him as being the man that dated Tanya, Richard Bocklid. He says later in the investigation, they found out that Mr. Bocklid had purchased a .45 caliber handgun, and when they checked his residence to see if the weapon was there, they found it was gone. Stack says authorities launched an immediate search for Bocklid. 6 days later, Royal Canadian Mounted Police found Richard's car in Thompson, Manitoba, Canada, more than 900 miles north of Kansas City. Richard was seen by 2 area residents, and then he dropped from sight. Warren Miller says that he thinks personally Richard is back in the United States. Now, this is airing 10 years or so after the murder, just to give a frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Miller says that he would have gotten tired of being without his family and that Richard's style was a little flashier and a little looser. He would have gotten tired of it and come back. It's strange, though, because I read that Bocklid was a really great outdoorsman and a bit of a survivalist. So he could have stayed out there, I think, for a bit. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that Warren Miller says that he would want to be around his family because if he was on the run, he theoretically wouldn't have contact with his family. So then why would he want to come back to them unless Warren believes that they're assisting him?
Mm.
So this is perhaps the most effed up part of the story, aside from the murder, obviously, is the cruelty after the murder. So 2 months after Tanya was murdered, her parents in Yugoslavia notified police that they received an unsigned letter postmarked September 16th, 1980, 2 days before Tanya's murder. Mm. The envelope was addressed in Richard's handwriting. Stack says that the letter was a vengeful diatribe that took the tone of a terrorist manifesto. Mm. And here is what the letter said. Dear Koprick family, Please realize it is most difficult for us to write this letter. However, we feel you deserve a complete explanation concerning the following events. Your daughter has been executed in Kansas City, Missouri. She has caused so much grief, turmoil, and anguish to so many Americans that this act was necessary.
Oh, God.
Tanya had lost all sense of her parameters. She mocked our nation. She mocked our people. She mocked our culture.
Shut up.
She attempted to dictate her pervasive will on everyone. She had been asked to leave our country, and she refused. It became clear that her only motive for being in this country was to become wealthy at the expense of anyone or anything. I hope you can begin to understand why her execution was inevitable. Please understand this act was performed by professional assassins and that no acts of revenge are possible. Sincerely, the people of the United States of America.
I will.
Can you imagine?
No. Also, this is somehow worse than your guy writing to the fam. I mean,
I know
they're both horrendous, but like this as a whole, like her parents are from another country and ugh.
It's absolutely appalling.
Ugh.
And now we learn that this wasn't a crime of passion or a last-minute decision out of despondency about finding out that he was fully kicked out of school. He was planning this. He wrote this 2 days before he shot her. He knew he was going to murder her.
Yep.
Ugh.
I hate him. I hate him. To do that to her family, to send that letter, is so unbelievably cruel.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's just cruel.
Yep.
So Stack says at the time of Tanya's murder, Richard Bocklage was 24 years old, and then they show one of the weirdest computer-aged photographs I've ever seen them do, because to me, he looks exactly the same as the other photo. So they age-progressed him from 24 to 34, which, I mean, admittedly, there's not that much change in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they didn't have very many good photos, because all the photos they show, his eyes are really in shadow. So I can't imagine that they were able to get a really good view of his face to even make this age-enhanced photograph. Mm-hmm. But it seems pretty useless to me. I think his hair's a little bit longer or something. And then my heart broke because there was no update.
Oh, right.
Because the case has never been solved.
Yep.
The most upsetting thing about this is that there is hardly any information around out there that isn't the same information repeated everywhere. Another frustrating thing is that Richard Bocklage was featured twice on America's Most Wanted, but for some reason, Fox will not release the old episodes of that show. Anytime they go on YouTube, they're taken down. It is impossible to get those old episodes. They're not on any network. You can't even buy them. Because I was like, I will buy these because it's happening a lot now. And you cannot get them.
I don't know.
I don't know what it is.
I mean, if someone's not still a wanted person, you certainly wouldn't want people to think they were.
Yeah, but if they were bad enough that they were on America's Most Wanted, they can suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's weird.
All I have like one news article and then I have the America's Most Wanted forum.
Hmm.
There was one case that I covered where I got to watch the America's Most Wanted. So there's some pirated ones on YouTube, but there are so many out there and we're never going to see them again. And then I read, because then I was like, I want to learn about America's Most Wanted. I'll spare you. But they never ran reruns for some reason. Mm. So if you didn't catch the episode, the chances of you seeing that episode again were really unlikely.
Hmm.
It's really interesting. There must be something specific behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the reasoning? Because they want to find people too, obviously.
Yeah. So sadly, I couldn't watch those segments. And usually if you watch Unsolved Mysteries and then America's Most Wanted, it's some of the same information, but then you get new information too and new photographs and new people interviewed, but I couldn't do it. So I just have some additional information that I was able to cobble together from comments on amwfans.com. So they came very close to never identifying or finding Richard's car. 6 days after the murder, a man in Manitoba, Canada, found Bocklage's 1975 Oldsmobile Tornado parked on a highway. The keys were in the ignition, and a note on the steering wheel said that whoever found the car could keep it.
Huh.
The note also said that the owner had gone back to the United States. Luckily, this person called the RCMP instead of the person just taking it and selling it or keeping it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah.
Otherwise, they may have never found out where his last known place was.
Yeah.
By the time it was identified as Baklage's car, it had been 12 days since the RCMP found it, and it was likely sitting there longer. So helicopters were flown over the area, but there was no foot search, and no one found his remains. In the early 80s, it sounds like it wouldn't have been that hard for Baklage to cross into Canada because there wasn't a national manhunt for him at the time, and communities with border crossings wouldn't have known anything about him or a murder in a far-off place like Missouri, and having a passport for border crossings was not that big of a deal pre-9/11 and even a little bit after that for Canada.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then some more tidbits from the AMWfans.com comments. There were two witnesses who saw Baklage shoot Kopric. They didn't show the other witness because it was a child. Quote, two neighbors who knew the couple were in the front yard of the apartment building. The killer then stared at them for seconds, and the woman covered her child with her body. But the killer did not shoot. He calmly walked to his car and drove away.
Mm-hmm.
Baklage had a pet 10-foot Burmese python, and he liked watching his python eat rabbits.
Oh, my God.
Snake people.
Gross.
We're going to get a listener be like, I'm a snake person.
I mean,
there's snake people who aren't like this.
Exactly. Do you enjoy watching an innocent mammal die from your snake? Probably not.
I think snake people that have to be nice to their snakes and stuff don't get off on watching this. But I don't know. I don't want to speak for snake people. I don't know.
And also mice. I mean, I could never watch that, but mice is also different.
Bunny rabbit.
Rabbits.
Yeah. Exactly. That's like eating a kitten or a puppy or something.
Ugh.
Right?
God. Yes.
It's terrible. So both of Baklage's parents have passed away, and the FBI had agents at both funerals, but Richard never appeared.
Oh.
Smart, right?
That's smart and so sad for his parents.
I know.
Like,
oh my God, I know.
Like, if the mom died first and the dad's like, maybe my son will finally show up. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they don't want him to.
I don't know.
What a weird life.
What a strange life to have a child that does something like that.
Yes, yes.
He has a sister who's still living in St. Louis. Detective Miller stated that they never found the .45 caliber handgun that Baklage used to kill Dr. Kopric, so maybe he had it on him, and that's why some people theorize that he took his life in the woods of Manitoba. Richard did have some help from at least one friend after the killing, because one of them dumped his pet snake into the tropical habitat at the Kansas City Zoo.
Oh, my God.
Ew. Also, you might be introducing diseases into that zoo.
Yes, a number of reasons why not.
Did that python then eat everything else in the tropical exhibit?
Oh my God.
Also, you don't think someone's going to notice a 10-foot Burmese python as an add-on? You don't think the zookeeper immediately was like, what the hell is this?
I mean, I'm sure they were, and then they have to deal with it.
Oh my God.
Yuck.
I hate that.
So sadly, the leads at Unsolved Mysteries in America's Most Wanted, both brought in, apparently never panned out, turning out to be unfounded most of the time. I wondered why there is nothing out there about this case, and I guess it could be that the police assume he's dead, right? Because we saw that with Brad Bishop. They took him off the Most Wanted list when they thought that he was dead. Or it could be that her family was in Yugoslavia, so there was no one here fighting for her. It could also be that so many men murder their partners that she just became another statistic, sadly.
God.
You know? I think it would help if he is still alive, which is, it's definitely possible. If he just went into Canada and he went to an area like, you know, Thompson or an area like Manitoba, he could have just disappeared.
Yeah.
The one thing that the investigation has clearly been hampered by is the fact that there aren't many good photographs of Richard available. Maybe check with his sister, and maybe she's at a point where she's willing to relinquish some of them. Because you remember with Donald Eugene Webb, the wife finally gave all those photographs over, and then people started calling in with tips because it wasn't just the one photograph that they had been using.
Yeah.
He had like different looks. It was from different angles, 6 or 7 different photographs, or maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly people were like, oh, I saw him.
Right.
And age enhancement technology is so much better compared to 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Better age enhanced photo could be pretty helpful.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's possible he's still alive, but there have been no public appeals or information besides the last America's Most Wanted broadcast in 2001. And then the last thing that I have is that I went over to the official Unsolved Mysteries page because I always go through the comments there. And someone posted that the family says he died in 2005. And in his mom's 2002 obituary, they refer to him as the late Richard G. Bocklage. But who knows? He could still be out there harming women better than him and feeding rabbits to reptiles.
Ugh, gross.
Yeah. True dick bitch.
Yeah, absolute true dick bitch for sure. Ugh. So that's it. I wish I had a more satisfying ending to that story.
It's so frustrating because, I mean, it's... any murderer should be caught, but he's so brazen. He did it in a parking lot. There was that woman walking by who heard it and had to hide behind a car. And then he sent that letter 2 days before. Like, it's just so brazen. How does he get away with it? Good job.
Thanks.
We hate him.
We hate him.
Okay. So we have what was aired as a wanted segment, but I would argue is more a missing person segment. And it's the story of missing U.S. Army Lieutenant Paul Wipke. So Paul Wipke had grown up in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was a ROTC honors graduate who, after basic training, started at Army Aviation School. In July 1956, he was posted at Fort Ord, California, and then in the summer of 1957 at Camp Desert Rock in Nevada. This part is terrible. I guess we hadn't learned our radiation lessons from World War II or any other times, and he was flying an observation plane near an atomic bomb testing site.
Can you imagine?
No protective gear. Obviously, and was exposed to several doses, like very high doses of radiation.
Oh my God.
And I could never figure out, was him flying that plane around that testing site part of the, was he part of the test, or was it just two things happening at the same time that shouldn't have been happening?
I don't think he was part of the test. I think they were just like, go check that out and see what it looks like.
Right.
Horrible, horrible. So, eventually, very quickly, he started noticing several blotches on his skin, and his teeth were severely damaged, and they had to all be removed within the next few months.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Just radiation is... How? Ugh. Especially after watching Chernobyl, I'll just never think about it the same way.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, it's serious. It's serious. And what is that book or film with Love, Hiroshima, or something like that? Is also so sad. So by all accounts, though, Lieutenant Paul Wipke was a very good soldier and a loyal family member. And even after the Army exposing him to several doses of radiation, he decides to stay. So he's a good soldier. He's a loyal family member. And what happens to him is very strange because of these things. So late in the afternoon on July 10th, 1958, he left Fort Ord in his red and white car, which looks like a Bel Air to me. I think it is. And I weirdly this morning was driving and I saw the exact same car that he drives.
What?
It's like red. It's a red and white one, too, with a top like his had. And it was in great condition driving past me. Isn't that so weird?
That is weird.
Very strange.
The exact same car.
Oh wow. Creepy.
I know. So he pulls out of Fort Ord and he tells the guard and a few friends that he's just going to Monterey, California, which is less than a mile away for a drink. But he never returned to the base. The next day, he was declared AWOL, which stands for absent without leave, and was declared a deserter 30 days after he vanished. On August 17th, 1958, so over a month later, a fish and game warden in Death Valley, California, found a car abandoned in the desert 42 miles from the nearest town. The keys were still in the ignition, and there was no sign of foul play, and the car seemed to be working fine. The car was registered to Lieutenant Paul Wipke, and it was almost 500 miles away from Fort Ord. So then when the car's reported, the Army says, Wipke's been missing for 5 weeks, but he's a deserter. And they kind of stick by that story, even though obviously something weird is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But no one who knows him believes this, and his brother, Paul Wipke, who's also a veteran, is like the one really looking for him and is the talking head in this segment. He's such a sweetie, it's really sad. So he says, quote, "I don't think Paul deserted. It was completely out of character for Paul to do such a thing. He was a loyal American soldier devoted to his work. I think the Army knew exactly what had happened to him. I think it was part of a big smokescreen cover-up."
Mm-hmm.
So we've got another possible military hide-and-shit situation.
Oh my gosh.
That's what these segments should be called.
Yes. The military is lying to you.
It goes all the way to the top is what these ones should be called.
Yeah.
So the Army says that according to their very little investigation, on the day Paul left, he apparently ended up at a motel in Mojave, California, 350 miles from the base, called the White's Motel, and he had signed the guest registry.
Hmm.
Army investigators say they found a gasoline receipt in Paul's car once that was eventually found, and it showed that he had bought gas in Mojave before his car ended up in Death Valley, 145 miles away. So he told everyone he's just going a mile away for a drink. He ends up really far away. Either he was never going for the drink,
mm-hmm.
or he was and something happened to him. Who knows? So on the morning that Paul turned up missing when he hadn't returned home, two soldiers went into his room at Fort Ord and removed everything, all of his personal belongings.
So weird.
All of his clothes, clear out his locker, everything is gone. And his brother, Carl, says that this is not how it's supposed to be. He was also in the Army. And he says, regulations state that the next of kin or legal representative must be notified before packing belongings. Mm. And they didn't notify us at the time. I was very suspicious of this action as soon as I discovered it had taken place.
Huh.
And they didn't find out that day, of course, that his stuff had all been cleared out. And obviously, why are you clearing his stuff out the following day
when he's not coming back.
Even declaring him a deserter 30 days later seems really fast.
Right. Yeah, it's a weird thing when it's someone in the military, so they have to declare something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you do if they're a missing person? So that's the AWOL thing, I guess. It just seems like there needs to be something more than either AWOL or deserter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. even AWOL sounds like they did it
by choice
on purpose mm-hmm. a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they're drunk somewhere or mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this is not great behavior from the Army. It's clearly showing you don't think he's coming back. Or if you do, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Why are you cleaning it out? And why are you not letting the family know you're cleaning his stuff, which is what they're supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
So another strange clue was that 4 weeks after he disappeared, a rancher noticed the car driving by him in Death Valley. So this is a car that sticks out. Like it's a red and white Bel Air. It's a nice, I mean, I don't know how much, if that's a nice car in that time, but it's like, looks nice
mm-hmm.
and would stick out in the middle of the desert. Like you'd notice a red car driving by you.
Mm-hmm.
And the eyewitness claimed that the man driving the car was wearing military clothes, mm-hmm. but Paul Wipke was wearing civilian clothes when he left Fort Ord.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is like 4 weeks after he goes missing and about 1 week before the car is found in Death Valley. Then, when the car was found a week later, a pile of cigarette butts were found next to the car, but Paul Wipke did not smoke.
Right. Do you know what I thought when I saw that in the reenactment?
What?
I was like, ugh, did somebody dump their ashtray out? I
didn't think. Oh my God. Like, littering?
How rude.
How could this story get any worse?
On top of everything else, they're littering? Like, I didn't think that the person, when they showed him later standing there smoking, I was like,
right.
Oh.
It's such a different life than what we live that.
In the reenactment, there's such a crazy amount of cigarettes in the pile.
Yeah, like someone was chain smoking.
How long was that guy standing there for? So I thought someone dumped their ashtray, yes. And I was outraged.
UM is like, and guess what else?
How could they?
They're a litter bug.
I mean, so that'll come up later because you chain smoke when you're bored.
Uh-huh.
You chain smoke when you're waiting around. I have been on the phone when I was visiting my friend in New York, standing outside, just smoking cigarette after cigarette, noticing how many I had smoked because I was bored and just chatting on the phone. So it happens. So was it Paul smoking those cigarettes? Most likely not, because he wasn't a smoker. Although I'm not a smoker and I was chain smoking cigarettes, so I don't know. It's something to do, though, with those hands and that mouth. It's something to do.
Yeah, and if you have, like, anxiety or whatever.
Yes, yeah, or if you've had a little bit to drink.
I'm just a social smoker. That's what my friends used to say. And I'd be like, buy your own fucking cigarette.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Okay, so another thing. So Paul's poor family, too. It's like he's given his life to the army, and then they feel like they're not getting any answers from them or that they're trying to help at all.
And it's like against his name, like saying he's a deserter.
Right.
Carlin, it's a lot like you had a segment where they came in and they took all of the stuff out of that woman's home.
Yes.
She didn't even know who they were.
Yep. They just up and took all his shit from his home.
Yeah.
It's just never a good look. Don't do it, because then you look like you know they're not coming back.
And you look like you're trying to hide what they have. Like, it's just a very...
God.
But I guess since it's the military, they're like, and what? Like, what are you going to do about it?
Right, that's what I was just going to say. It's too big. You can't go up against
them. You can't fight City Hall. You certainly can't fight the military.
So Carl tells us that it was only by accident that he even heard anything about the car being found at all. He says the only way that I learned about the car was due to an unofficial call I placed to an enlisted man at Fort Ord. Within half an hour, he called back very excited and he said, "This is classified information," and requested that I not tell anyone where I had heard it. So they weren't even going to tell him, like the higher ups. This guy just says it, who had heard it at Fort Ord. And that's the other thing. It's like, who's handling this case, the army or the police? And then it's in Death Valley, which is 350 miles away from Fort Ord. So it's just like there's things are probably also falling through the cracks and getting covered up. It's too many people. And if one person says, "Hey, the army's handling this," wink, wink, everyone else is going to be like, "All right, I'm backing up." So Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lewis, who was Paul's commanding officer, was surprised that he was declared a deserter. And Charles was told not to look into the case anymore. So then he starts thinking about how he had seen Paul talking to two men in civilian clothing, but like nice suits, and another soldier at the base a few times. And there's a reenactment of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lewis walking up to these men and saying, "I need to see your ID. This is a closed base." He asks Paul and the other soldier, "Is everything okay?" They're like, "Yeah, but it seems a little bit shady." And this is what's frustrating. So Charles Lewis asks them for their IDs. They show it to him and verify who they are, but it doesn't say what agency they're from. And also, can he not remember their names?
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess it wouldn't stick with you if you just looked at it once, but it would be really helpful if he could remember their names.
Mm-hmm.
So the men met with Paul several more times within the next few weeks on the base, and after that, Charles Lewis says that his personality began to change. He thinks that the two men may have been from the CIA and that they may have met with Paul in order to recruit him and have him go on secret missions, which I guess was happening a lot during this time. So in January of 1958, Paul told his brother Carl that he was going on an assignment and that he was going to, quote, make a name for himself, but he couldn't tell him any more about that. And then during that conversation, other people started walking by his desk, and so he kind of hushed down about it, and that's all that Carl heard.
Hmm.
So then Carl also theorizes that Paul was recruited into an Army CIA program that was occurring, and when he left the base, maybe he met with CIA agents while at the White Sands Motel, and that he was transferred from nearby Edwards Air Force to Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And then he believes that at that time, maybe he also turned his car over to the CIA or the Army. They waited a little while, and then they drove it out to Death Valley to get rid of it. Hmm. Which would make sense why the one witness, 4 weeks after his disappearance, saw someone in military clothing driving the car in Death Valley.
Yeah.
In June of 1977... so, way later, Carl contacted the FBI in order to find more information about Paul from their files, but he was later told that the files on Paul's case had been destroyed. Carl says, quote, "I think the Army took his car out to the desert to get rid of it. Out of sight, out of mind. If they would just say, yes, he died on a secret mission, we could live with that. We're all loyal American citizens in our family, and we would buy that. And until the Army tells us what happened, there will be no peace in our family." So sad. So then, and I should say, too, this case is also featured on The Trail Went Cold.
Oh.
Yeah, episode 135, I think. And he talks a little bit about this part coming up, so which they don't go into in UM very much. But Carl also finds that a friend of Paul's, Lieutenant Charlie Guess, who served with him at Camp Desert Rock and again at Fort Ord, mm-hmm. had vanished while flying a plane 11 days after Paul vanished.
Yeah.
What?
Which is, what are the chances of that? Over a year later, Charlie's remains were found with his plane north of Death Valley, but the plane that was found with him had a different serial number than the one he was supposed to have taken off
in. What?
Oh my God. And also, it's in Death Valley.
What?
Just what is happening?
What is happening?
What is happening? In 1982, the Army changed his status from deserter to died in the line of duty. And say they believed he died the day after he vanished while he was in the desert.
Okay.
Huh. But it's still not. They're not, then they won't say anything more because it's really not died in the line of duty if you're saying he wasn't doing military operations during mm-hmm. that time.
Yeah.
It'd be he died of natural causes or he was murdered right. or something uh-huh. like that. So why are they saying died in the line of duty and then saying nothing else? So Carl and his family still want more to be mm-hmm. revealed by the Army or the CIA about Paul's case. And he's on there just in the hopes that someone who was with Paul at Fort Ord around the time of his disappearance might know something else. Maybe Paul also mentioned something about this secret mission. Maybe that other soldier that had been with Paul when the two civilian clothing men came and talked to them could say something.
Yeah.
But there was no update, and the case remains unsolved. So one thing that Carl thought, though, is that maybe he died on a secret mission with the CIA, but also maybe he died from the atomic testing and the radiation.
Okay, that makes sense.
Oh, my God.
And the Army covered up his death because they were responsible for his radiation
poisoning. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that tracks.
Their fault.
That makes sense.
But then why not just, they already knew, the family already knew that he had received a large amount of radiation because of his dealings in the Army, because mm-hmm. of flying that plane near that test, and that the Army had messed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So give this family some peace instead of first saying he's a deserter
yeah.
and then forever making them wonder what happened to him.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right.
Because maybe in the little part in them thought maybe he is in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Maybe he's such an American citizen that he is keeping this a secret from us and he's living there. I don't think they ever really did think that, but any little sliver
of hope
that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, another thing is the case was originally classified as wanted on the April 3rd, 1991 episode viewing
uh-huh.
or airing instead of a missing persons case, which is just not the correct classification for the segment.
Yeah.
So that's it. There's no, his body's never been found. No other information has ever come out. Obviously, Carl worked for a very long time to find some answers to what happened to his brother by going on the show and pushing the army to reclassify. Mm-hmm. But Paul's never been found. So the only thing I could find was that Carl, though, lived a really long life. He died at the age of 92 in 2019.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then his obituary says he was preceded in death by his wife of 65 years, mm-hmm. Gloria Wipke, his daughter, Carla, and then the obituary said, and brother, Paul Wipke, who was killed in action in 1958 while serving in the Army.
Wow.
So I don't know if that obituary means that he accepted that, because the killed in action thing, I guess that's true. If that's what happened, even if it was a CIA mission or something.
I don't know. Or I guess maybe the killed in action thing, if he did die of the radiation, I think maybe the army was like, okay, well, technically,
yeah,
he was killed in action. And also that will make the family
happy. Yeah.
And then maybe everyone can stop talking about this.
Yeah.
So maybe it was sort of like a just give it to them kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get everybody to stop talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a son that was still alive and granddaughter and two great-grandchildren and was a World War II veteran and served in the Army Air Force. So it's really sad. Ugh. It's quite a sad case. And who knows what happened, and that military ain't ever going to say, honey.
No.
No.
It must feel so bad for these families.
I mean, we never, on these, never. It's never going to get solved unless his body was found. But if it's an army cover-up, the body's not going to be found.
Nope. Yeah. Well, and the car thing, like, I mean, clearly something happened because someone was driving his car around and it wasn't him.
Yeah.
Yep. And I saw it just this morning. I saw someone driving it this morning.
They're still driving that car around.
They're still trying to hide that thing way up here.
They're going to go park it someplace in the wilderness.
No, you know what? They're probably en route to Spokane.
Yes, girl.
Oh, for sure.
All roads lead to Spokane.
All right. That's All right. it.
Hey. Okay, guys, so tune in next week for part two of this episode where we will be talking about the cases of
A Lost Loves about Gary Bickman
and a missing persons / we think it's actually a wanted segment for Astarte Davis.
That name.
I know. Well, oh my gosh, we'll get into it.
Right.
I cannot wait.
Okay, so you guys can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, extra episodes, early episodes, goodies in the mail. To see photos that we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast, on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can go to resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or you can write us a paper letter at our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stacks. You can send us anything that you think we'd be interested in hearing about, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like us, leave a 5-star review. We'll send you a magnet if you do. And for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to an organization. And for this month, that is Angels with Misplaced Wings.
We love you.
We love you so.
See you next week.
Leave a review. That's your homework.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Pacing for each one.
Also, you can't say clap. That's a 1, 2, 3, 4
oh
count.
Oh my god. Every time.
We may as well not do it.
Oh my God, that is funny. Okay, do it again,
Allison. We don't have to do it again.
Oh man.
All right, take it down. Take it down. Okay.